It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Our country reached a milestone recently, the 1 millionth organ transplant surgery, more than any other country in the world. And that's from the United Network for Organ Sharing. That's the agency overseeing donations and transplants, which has come under congressional scrutiny for organs going to waste. Join in on organ and tissue donation, the process, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Conversation is right here, 800-642-1234. Adam Schneider is a nurse practitioner with UW Organ and Tissue Donation in Madison. Adam, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Hey, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. Well, let's for a moment just take stock of the 1 millionth organ transplant in the U.S. What does that number mean to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's an incredible feat to make, obviously, a million transplant happen. And it involves so many people like the hospital providers, the nurses, the social workers, the OR techs, et cetera. But I think what's more important behind that is the number of how many donors it takes to make that transplant happen. I mean, without those organ donors, those 1 million transplants wouldn't be there. And so I think it's interesting that the work that my team does is entirely with those donors. I actually rarely see any transplant recipients because we come in when a patient has a devastating injury and they're not going to survive. And we work with that patient and that family to see how maybe organ donation can be something positive that can come from something obviously really terrible for someone who is dying.
Can you just acquaint us with your team and the system of processes that happen within organ and tissue donation procurement? You know, you're in a program that has been doing this for a long time, over 50 years.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting that my program, so I work with University of Wisconsin, organ and tissue donation, and we collaborate with up to 100 and I think 10 or 11 hospitals throughout the state of Wisconsin. And so anytime a patient has a devastating injury in an ICU, we're contacted to be notified to watch to see if something bad happens. And so it's rare. Only about 2% of people pass away in a way that organ donation can actually happen, which is why it's even more important when a potential donor is able to happen, because it's so rare. And so our team is contacted, and then we work with the bedside staff, the ICU nurses, the physicians, et cetera. And we work with, as you said, UNOS, who kind of maintains the list as to who's the sickest, who's been waiting the longest. And we use that matching system to find appropriate recipients. And so our team kind of gets involved in maximizing the donation. So we try and make sure that these organs are, transplantable, basically. Many times these patients go through a pretty bad situation. And so even though we're not going to be able to save their life anymore, we try and do interventions that will help make those organs work in someone else.
It's just amazing that small number of situations that are eligible for being able to donate organs. I wasn't aware of that. And that what must mean that there is that type of match opportunity, you are flying basically anywhere to get to that donor's hospital.
Yeah, a lot of people think, you know, maybe when I pass away in a, you know, a car accident or in like a hospice situation or something like that I can donate, but it's usually not those types of situations, because the organs need to be viable for transplant. And so it really mostly happens in ICUs, but because of that rare number, we really advocate for people to make their decision known on the Wisconsin State Registry, because in those very small circumstances, it's so important, that if we want to be able to save a life, that decision is either known by that person. And if they don't make that decision for themselves, then someone else can make that decision for them, like their next of kin, whoever is taking care of them.
The data from the federal government says 17 people die each day waiting for an organ transplant. What is needed to reduce wait times?
You know, that's what my job is. My job is to, like I said, maximize the donation. So when we do have organ donors, I've implemented a lot of things that help improve the organ utilization, so that we don't just have an organ donor, but we're only able to recover, kidneys or maybe their heart's not functioning well. And so that's kind of my job, and that's what I'm always looking forward to, is what kinds of things can we do to use more of the organs from those patients, so that they are transplanted, and then those people that are dying are continuing to wait.
What would be an example of such an innovation?
One would be, what I've worked through is a lung management process for our team. And so we actually work through it by using medications that take fluid off of lungs. We do what's called recruitment maneuvers. So we use the ventilators to kind of mimic a cough and a deep breathe in these patients, because they can't do that on their own. Mm. So I've kind of standardized that kind of practice. And so we actually work through those interventions, like the diuretics and the recruitment maneuvers, to reverse lung dysfunction. And then we evaluate the lungs, and we found that so many more lungs are able to be transplanted. I think we did, like, in our first practice of this, we usually donate about 30 lungs. We had done about 20 lungs, mm-hmm. In about a year, and we did about 30 lungs after the interventions were implemented.
We have nurse practitioner Adam Schneider fielding questions on organ and tissue donation, the processes involved. Join in 800-642-1234. You're listening to The Morning Show, and there's more conversation ahead here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. More than 1,600 Wisconsinites are waiting for an organ donation right now. Nearly 4 out of 5 need a kidney, and that is from UNOS, the agency that collects and reports data on every U.S. organ donor, transplant candidate, recipient, outcome. Join in on your organ donation or transplant experience, 800-642-1234. Nurse practitioner Adam Schneider is with UW Organ and Tissue Donation, stays with us. Let's take a call now. Marcus is with us from Milwaukee. Marcus, what's your story?
Okay, good morning. So I saw a program on public television, love public radio, love public television, fantastic. About 3 months ago, I think it was, where they were talking about, it was a system where there was a woman who wanted to donate a kidney to a very close friend of hers, but they weren't a blood match. They were able to set up through an algorithm and actually, like, network it. And so it was like they were able to trade, like, kidneys, because there was a number of people who wanted to donate kidneys, but they weren't a direct match. And so they were able to, like, figure it out. And I think they solved, I think it was like 12 additional lives were saved because of it. And I just wondered what your guest thoughts were on something like that. And to everyone listening out there, 197 more people, and they get
Marcus,
$25,000.
Appreciate it, Marcus. Adam, go ahead.
Yeah, I don't work a ton with the transplant side with living donation, because I work with the deceased, mm-hmm. the patients who are dying in those ICUs. But what I can say is what he's talking about is a paired kidney exchange. And so, yeah, it's pretty cool. There's almost like 100,000 people waiting for kidneys or whatever. So it's wait times are really long for kidney transplants, because what you can do is just put that patient on dialysis and kind of hold them until a kidney is available for transplant. And so that's why a lot of people, you might see signs kind of like out and about saying, are you a match for my kidney? Because the blood type is of obvious importance. And then there's other types of matching too, that's done, called like histocompatibility and HLA. And it's kind of complex. So when people are able to look into if they're a match for someone else, it might not necessarily just mean that they're a match for that person, but maybe they could be a match for someone else. And then it could be like a domino where they could help maybe someone else who gets another kidney for them.
I'm wondering about transportation of these organs, because we've been seeing the Senate Finance Committee investigating UNOS, the agency that oversees donations and transplants, and the amount of complaints about transportation and numerous missed flights leading to canceled transplants and discarded organs between 2010 and 2020. What can be done to improve the transportation and handling of these organs?
Yeah, we're doing a ton of different things from, first of all, what I'd say is we're always, I think everyone's experiencing issues across the industry. So like whether it's staffing shortages. You go to your local restaurant, it's hard to find someone. And so, I mean, I've heard of, in the United Kingdom that some of their airports have been on lockdown forever. So it's been tricky to make sure that organs can get where they're needed. And so, we do take jets for certain organs when time is really of the essence. And when an organ does have time, it does go on kind of another, just a normal plane, like the same kind that you would take to go to Florida. It might be underneath in the cargo area to get to that recipient, which is really cool. But obviously, it's complicated. It's the same as losing your luggage. And so I personally have never experienced anything like that. So I have not had, luckily, not to focus on those kinds of things, because our organization does not have issues with that kind of transportation. But we do have issues when it comes to getting organs to the destination timely. And so some things that we're doing is looking at how we can prolong the amount of time that an organ can be outside of the body before it gets transplanted, because if you've got more time, then you're not as rushed. And so one of those is, for example, I've been working with, or at least our team has been working with, a third-party vendor who provides a service called ex vivo lung perfusion. And it's a really cool device. Basically, it takes the lungs and it makes them function outside of the body, hence the word ex vivo. And many times in our organ donors, you can run into issues with improving lung function. Maybe they were involved in a car accident, or maybe they have some sort of issue with their rib cage that causes their lungs not to open up all the way. And so ex vivo lung perfusion allows us to take these lungs outside of the body, put them on the machine, and then reopen them and reassess them before we put them into the recipient. And it also prolongs the amount of time that we have to be able to put these organs into a transplant recipient, so that we can make sure that the appropriate transportation is set up. So it's those kinds of things that help make sure that the organ is used.
Adam, thank you for joining us.
No problem at all.
Adam Schneider is a nurse practitioner with UW Organ and Tissue Donation in Madison. Up ahead, we talk about the latest sites added to Wisconsin's historical registry. The state's historic preservation officer is with us. I'm Kate Archer Kent. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. The National Park Service oversees the National Register of Historic Places. That's the official list of our country's historic places that are worthy of preservation. A little over 2,400 sites are in Wisconsin. We explore recent additions to the register with the Wisconsin Historical Society. Join in at 800-642-1234. Dinah Penkunas is State Historic Preservation Officer. Dinah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning. And just some clarification to start out. What is the difference between sites that are listed on the National Register, run by the National Park Service, versus our state register here in Wisconsin?
Absolutely. So it's actually part of the same process. Our process is to review properties for listing both in the state and the National Register. And they start out with our state review board, which reviews all of those nominations coming forward and then makes the recommendation to send them on to the National Park Service. So we get listings first in the state register, and then we move them on to the Park Service for listing in the National Register.
Oh, I see. So being in one, the National Register, or being in the state register, doesn't necessarily mean you'll be in the National Register?
Well, we tried to make sure that the
Okay.
properties that we are sending through will end up that way.
Okay.
Yes.
And it's not just buildings, it's lighthouses and downtown districts that we'll talk about. Can you give us a sense of the range of things that can make it on the Wisconsin Register?
Yes. So we have bridges, we have shipwrecks, we have archaeological sites, we have parks, resorts. Places like our state capital. So it's really anything that is a place, place-based history.
How extensive is the research process and the paperwork to get on the official state register?
So you need to have enough information to make a case of why this is an important property. And of course, that's going to depend on, you know, the complexity. So if you have, for example, a lovely Queen Anne house that's being nominated because it's architecturally important, all nominations require you first to describe the property and then to make a case for what is called significance. So why is it important? How does it stand out in the community? And, you know, depending again on the property, how much research is going to be needed. So we tell people that, you know, they really should give themselves a year to get through the process.
Hmm. Are you seeing any type of backlog to keep up with applications for the register?
Yes. So we have about a one cycle backlog at the moment. Our board meets quarterly and we look at anywhere from 8 to 10 different properties. And so we're sort of operating at any time having about another 10 waiting in the wings. And as we process those, another 10 are coming in.
Well, let's get to these properties, starting with the Gonstead Clinic, which was recently added. The Clinic of Chiropractic, built in 1964, Mount Horeb. What is historically notable about this still operating chiropractic clinic?
So this this property, again, as you mentioned, in Mount Horeb, is interesting both, you know, as a work of architecture. It's, if you look at it in aerials, which we have on our website at wisconsinhistory.org, it looks like a spine. It's actually a fascinating building architecturally. But it's also important for its association with Dr. Gonstead, who really revolutionized the practice of chiropractic and introduced an entire new system of dealing with spinal pain. And, you know, this is the one where a lot of the history reading about it and really learning about the clinic and Dr. Gonstead, which makes it such a fascinating story. He saw about 200 patients a day.
Wow.
If you can imagine that. And worked about 20 hours a day, seeing people who flew in from really all over the world to come to Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, to be treated by him. And he established clinics, there are clinics all over the world, actually, that practice the Gonstead method. So there we go. In Mount Horeb, Wisconsin, something that really changed the practice of chiropractic medicine across the world. And that is one of those great stories that we're so happy to bring forward both to our board, but also to send to the Park Service and be able to share the story with everybody about the great history, both of chiropractic medicine, about the Gonstead Clinic, and Mount Horeb, Wisconsin.
One thing that seemed to be stressed in the Gonstead application is that the building is still highly intact. How significant is that for a building?
So it is one of the things that we look at for eligibility for the National Register. You know, properties still have to be recognizable for what they are. If we're looking at a building and saying, you know, I can understand, for example, if we're listing a school or an industrial building, you know, does it still have that characteristic of the period in which we're assessing its importance? And so with the Gonstead Clinic, you know, they've really maintained it almost the way it was left by Dr. Gonstead. You know, the photographs, you look at it, it's stepping back in time, even on the interior with the furniture and the finishes and all of the exterior features. So it is something that's important, but we're always really excited to see things that are really reflective of that period in which we're evaluating it.
Looking at new additions to the State Registry of Historic Places, we have Dinah Penkunas, who's the Wisconsin Historical Society's State Historic Preservation Officer. Let's move on to the Kewaunee Pierhead Lighthouse at the confluence of the Kewaunee River and Lake Michigan, now in the State Registry. What is unique about this lighthouse?
So lighthouses, as we can imagine, you know, anywhere along coastal Wisconsin, there's such important features of the landscape. And they tell, again, those important stories of both the maritime history of the state, but also the development of some of these coastal communities and the necessity for harbors and allowing ships to safely navigate into these harbors, such as in Kewaunee, which is a pierhead light. So it's really guiding boaters into the harbor. And these lighthouses are really reflective of, you know, the federal government's interest in creating a safe way of passage in the Great Lakes. And I was just looking this morning to see how many lighthouses we have listed, and we have over 30. Looks like this might be our 35th lighthouse listing when this is designated. So, you know, if we think about all those communities, we have lighthouses like this one, which are the pier headlights. We have ones, you know, that are isolated on rocky outcroppings, others that are set more inland. So they all tell this wonderful story. And then just to think about the fact that, you know, a lighthouse such as this one, you know, it's close into town, but you had to walk along, you know, that very, very long pier there to get to the lighthouse. And people live there, lived on the light because you had to keep monitoring it and make sure the light was working and the fog signals were working. You know, most of them are now automated and there aren't lightkeepers, if you think about it.
That's what I found so interesting. I mean, this was built as a fog signal building, and now a modern automated fog signal and a fog detector are mounted on the lantern gallery. And yes. I was like, you know what, just shows how the old and the new can work together. Not a big deal.
Right. And the nice thing is that we still have that lighthouse, and it's such a symbol for the community of Kewaunee. You know, it is an identifying sort of landmark that that Kewaunee sees, you know, its identity embodied in.
Well, let's go to the Bangor Commercial Historic District now on the registry. This is the district in downtown, the village of Bangor, small community in La Crosse County. What is in this district of buildings?
So there are 20 buildings. It's two stretches of a downtown in, as you said, in a small community of Bangor. And this is representative of so many communities as well. So, but the specific case in Bangor, you know, this is where its downtown developed, where the services were. The railroad passed through. It was an agricultural support community. And so when we look at districts like this, it again helps to explain how these communities grew and developed. And this one is really interesting in that, you know, a lot of the buildings date, you know, from the early 20th century, like a lot of downtowns or late 19th, early 20th century. Bangor had a couple of fires, lost some buildings. They were replaced over time. And really, there are very few new additions. There's a new bank in the downtown, but it really is capturing, again, this what was a vibrant downtown in the turn of the century and still remains the commercial core for the community of Bangor.
That's so wonderful, too. And how it stretches from, you know, 1870s all the way, I think, to World War II. So it's a real,
yes.
It's a span.
Yeah. Yes. And so, you know, as things change in the downtown, the newest building, you know, there's a modern bank, but the post-war building, there's a like the City Hall police station type of building that was built on the edge of downtown. So they kept everything within that core. And even as the nomination notes, the one modern building in the downtown is the bank, which did demolish two other buildings to build this new bank. But the fact that the bank remained in the downtown is also significant. You know, you're not moving out to the outskirts. You're keeping that important financial institution right in the core of the community on its main street.
We only have a few seconds left, but Dina, what do property owners gain from getting their property listed on historic registries?
So one of the big benefits for private property owners is the ability to use tax credits to support the rehabilitation of the buildings to help offset some of the costs. So Wisconsin has a number of tax credit programs administered by our office in the National Park Service. There are state tax credits if you own a historic house, and that is a 25% credit on exterior and systems work. You do have to have it approved by our office before you start, but it's a nice benefit. Mm. And then there are state and federal tax credits for income-producing buildings, and those are both 20%, both on the state and federal. So, you know, these downtown buildings in Bangor could apply for the income-producing credits. And again, those are to help rehabilitate and make updates or
maintain too,
you know, yes. Improvements. Yes.
Dina, thank you for joining us.
Absolutely.
Dina Penkunas is the Wisconsin Historical Society's State Historic Preservation Officer. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network.